Insurance gets a bad name. Like, I wasn't actually a believer for the longest time. You know, I was reluctantly even insured my car. I'll roll the dice. And then pretty much every day, because now that's what I do, is I call insurance leads, or people wanting insurance. And every day I'm talking to people that have heart problems, cancer, that they can't walk, they can't work, and they're in a horrible position. Like, even trying to, like, if you've got cancer, you have a mortgage, and then you get on the sickness benefit, well, there goes your house, $300 after tax. That's going to help you survive, isn't it? So this one's a more in-depth understanding about the health system here in New Zealand, as well as trying to get clarity on how to communicate more effectively as a financial advisor to make sure that you don't do a disservice to the people you come across. Because every time you don't sign someone up that needed it, you're doing a disservice, because they're going to be in a position where they're waiting too long for the care they need. They're not getting the right drugs that could actually save their lives or prolong their lives. Or they're financially ruined where the actual employer has to fire them because they can't afford to keep them on. Like, you know, you got an employee, they love you, you have an amazing rapport, but eventually, if you're not making money, you're not making money for the company, you got to go. That's the nature of business. Business is personal, and people might say, oh, that's horrible, we shouldn't think like that. Well, I'm afraid that's the reality of the world. It's like gravity. Oh, I get so upset that, you know, when I jump off stairs, I fall over. Well, that's the reality. So you could either put your head under a blanket and pretend it's not going to happen, or you could actually get an understanding of what's the right cover for you, what's the right person to talk to. And if you're the person that facilitates those two things, you need to communicate more effectively, because every time you don't sign someone up, you're letting them down. So let's jump into it. How many staff are you up to now in your company?
Well, we've sort of got several business models. We've got two FAPs, so called financial advice providers. The license. And so you've got to be licensed today to be able to give financial advice, which includes insurance advice. And you become a financial advice provider, and that's called a FAP. And so we have two of those. So one is Adelphi Financial Services, and under that we have a number of what's called authorized bodies. So they're authorized their own business, and they are authorized to operate under our license. But our main engine is Adelphi Insurance Brokers. And so in that, we have around about 12, 13 advisors spread throughout New Zealand. And we have about 10 staff in the office. We've just taken on a social media person. So, yeah, social media lead. Digital marketing is probably a better term for it. We have an IT person who runs our CRM and all the IT we have, because we're pretty much paperless. We have a full-time KiwiSaver specialist in the office, and he's teaching someone else. We have our own compliance officer, and we've got a sort of receptionist, and then we have, when I say receptionist, we don't really have walk-in people. Most of our clients we visit in their homes, because we're spread nationally, and our guys operate in the different centres. And we have about four people sitting in our call centre. You know, some of that's outbound, a lot of that is inbound. So, and so the authorised bodies sitting under there, we have about half a dozen at the moment. That'll grow to around about 20 by the end of the year.
Oh.
So that'll be cool. And each of those sort of has staff within that. And so our goal is to provide an environment for them to be able to succeed in their business and take a lot of the pressure of running the license off them.
Yeah. What makes you think it's going to get to 20 all of a sudden? You go 13 to 20, what's the plan, mate? How are you pulling that off?
Look, just that we've had a number of people approach us, because with the change in regulation, a lot of people ran out, thought, oh, we'll get our own license and this will be nice and easy. And look, it is easy to apply for a license. You just tick the box with the FMA and they do a check on you. And if it all comes back nice and clear, they'll grant you the license. But then it's running the license. So how do you run it? You know, I guess we have the scale to be able to support the people to, you know, whether it's with the PI cover, whether it's the CRM, you know, the data recording. Yeah, and so forth. And look, probably the other thing, Ryan, I think a lot of people out there, it was a good idea, but then they're on their own. You know, who do they come to? Who can they bounce ideas off? And so now they're coming back in and saying, well, okay, should I want the license anymore? I'd just like to operate, if I could operate under your license and be part of something a little bit bigger. So we've had quite a bit of inquiry for that. And without confusing the issue, we also have another license called NZ Risk Services. And that is a joint venture we've set up with Astute Financial Management. Astute Financial Management are a very large Australian mortgage aggregator. You know what I mean by aggregator?
No idea, but I'll be done with the audience so you can teach us.
Well, so if one person goes to to the bank, for example, and says, "Look, I want to be a mortgage broker. Can you give me an agency to market your products?" Well, they won't allow you to do that. So being part of an aggregator, it aggregates different businesses' volume together, and you all benefit from the uplift. So if you're talking in the insurance space, if you don't have a couple of years experience now, an insurer is not going to give you an agency to market their products. But if you're part of a group, then you can. And also commissions, you won't get full commissions, but we can aggregate all the commissions under one umbrella, and it gives us a scale, and they can operate from that scale. Hmm. And so does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so with Astute, they're a mortgage broking aggregator. They're specialists in that. They have a number of brokerages. The Mortgage Express brand operates under that, and so we've set up another license to allow the people that want to run a mortgage broking business, and they can aggregate that through the Astute FAP, and they can do the insurance, and we train them, we support them through the insurance side of it, because that's what we're specialists in. I don't know a lot about mortgages, to be fair. I mean, I've got one, but I don't know. That side of the business is not my field of expertise whatsoever. Risk, the insurance side is mine.
Yeah, they have such a complementary combination. It's like the easiest person to motivate to get insurance is the one that's just signed a big commitment with the bank.
Yeah.
And they're mostly invested in the home. Well, who do you think are the best fishermen in the sense of people that have access to your dream clients for insurance brokers?
Fishermen? How do you mean, people that we are trying people we're looking at onboarding, you mean?
So like partnerships. So think I could go every day and go get clients, or I could find someone that already knows them and we have and befriend the fishermen so that we have shared interests. So they provide the mortgage, I provide the insurance, and then it just makes it much more efficient way. So who do you think are the most valuable partnerships for insurance brokers?
Well, I think that the one you just said there, the mortgage broker is a little bit of it's a hand in a glove thing, because I mean, with us, with Adelphi, we really believe that your most valuable asset is your ability to earn income. And even if you want to create wealth, you've got a lot of that is the income that your income is supporting, servicing the debt initially until your assets are starting to fund themselves. So even the house, so just a first time home buyer, will have a mortgage, but that paying that mortgage is dependent on their ability to earn income. And if that goes for whatever reason, then the house goes. It is a nice fit. Not everyone sort of sees that, particularly younger people. It's not going to happen to me. I'll be fine. But even with life insurance, it's a form of income replacement or income protection, because if someone is to die, there is no more income whatsoever coming into that household from that person again, ever. And you think of someone in their mid-30s, maybe on 100K income, there's $3.5 million that would come into that house. And that's what we're looking to protect. If they got a sickness, illness, unable to work, then again, putting some form of income replacement strategy in place. And it's not just like income protection. It might be a whole suite of products. It's getting the product mix right. So yes, I mean, it is a good fit, but it's helping people understand the risk. So what happens? I was just talking to a group. I was talking to a group member day yesterday in Auckland, and I was talking about that very thing. So in this case, a real estate agent has gone out and they've found your dream, because most people, their home is their dream. Their big dream really isn't to own a home. Initially, they'll have other dreams, but that is a big dream for a lot of people, home ownership. And so the real estate agent's found it. The mortgage broker's going to fund it, or will give you the means to fund it. But now you've got to protect the income that's going to pay for it. And so that's where we come in. And so you're right, mortgage broking and a mortgage advisor is a very good fit.
I've been trying to work out how to actually sell insurance, because it's like trying to convince someone they're going to die. And it's almost like, I feel like religion almost exists because people are afraid of that and they need somewhere to go, yeah. Like heaven.
Yeah.
So how do you convince people that are in complete denial about their health? And, you know, I've got diabetes, it's fine, I take my meds. Yeah, but you might go blind and lose a leg. What's how do you make it important?
good question. I mean, if someone's got that mindset, we probably aren't going to convince them. but we, look, I think it's a matter of really, you know, sitting down with somebody and asking them the question. So what if, you know, so like suddenly you're, I mean, if I was talking with a couple, for example, Bob and Mary's always a great couple. I think everyone in all industries use Bob and Mary. But, you know, sitting down with Bob and Mary and just sort of saying, you know, look, I guess explaining what it is, you know. So risk insurance is saying, if Bob was to die unexpectedly tomorrow, what financial risk does that expose your family to? You know, so what happens, Mary, if Bob doesn't come home tomorrow? Yeah, you know, Bob might pop up and say, oh, she'll do this or that. And you say, no, Bob, you're not here, right? You didn't come home, remember? So now Mary's got to make some decisions. Now what happens? So if we're looking at say life insurance, for example, we would be talking to the person and saying, okay, what would we need to clear? So ideally it would be debt. It'd be mortgage debt, so that Mary's got a and the kids have a debt-free home, so that pressure's gone off on that. And then who do we need to protect? Now, there is life cycles with life insurance. You know, people have different needs at different times. Probably the person that needs it the absolute most is a young couple with a mortgage and young kids. Because, you know, and if let's just say Bob is, you know, because it can be both ways. In today's world, it's very often the lady that's out earning the income. But let's just say Bob's the key income earner. He's taken out. What now happens to Mary? So, and then putting a number behind that. So if the kids are just, the children might be two or three, you might say, okay, so Mary, if Bob were taken out unexpectedly tomorrow, and we could get rid of the debt, you know, so you've now got a debt-free home, what would you still need, or maybe even replace his income for a period? It might be 2 years, might be 5 years, it might be through to the kids are 14, or it could be right through the children leave school. So we're building a sort of a number around it. So it's not just a guess. It's like, hey, you need $100,000 or $1 million, or you need $500,000. Let's actually apportion that to something. Now, that will change, because let's just say we came up with a figure of $1 million. The mortgage is $500,000. Mary needed, say, maybe $500,000, $50,000 a year for 10 years to bring up the kids, not work and bring up the kids, because that might have been their wish. As the mortgage is now dialed down, they don't need so much there. And the children then grow up, leave home, they've got their own lives, their own incomes. You don't need so much there. So you can dial that amount of life insurance down. And look, the insurances might shift. So now you're looking at something like trauma. And that is if someone has a serious illness, and cancer, stroke, heart attack, types of paralysis are probably the most common in those. But you're going to survive it. So you haven't died, so there's no payout. So if someone's got a life-threatening cancer, it might take them a year or two to get through that, to fight their way through that, and they may not be able to work. So now your needs move. And I use the term living insurance. So life insurance should really be called death insurance, you know, because you only get it if you die. Well, you don't get it, so your loved ones get it. But then what if something serious happens to you and you may not be able to work for the rest of your life? Or you've got a serious illness and you need to go through chemotherapy, radiotherapy, And it takes you, you know, it might take you a year or two to get back on your feet. Or you've got a short-term illness. And so the next question I'd be asking somebody if I'm sitting down in front of them is, so what happens, how long could you survive without income? And then that's building that out. And then it's really, we produce a personal protection plan. Other people in the industry will call it something slightly different. Statement of advice is a common term. And then we would come back with our client, and then we would sort of say, okay, here's the optimum level of cover. So you know, if what I've actually recommended to you is what I believe is your optimum level of cover. Now, this is going to be your budget. So here's the optimum level of cover. I might be lucky and I've got a bang on for the budget, or there might be a gap. So let's spend the next 20 or 30 minutes getting the ideal level of cover, but being affordable. There's no point me giving you all this insurance if you can't afford it, because then it defeats the purpose. And then we work through the life cycle of that client. You know, we want to be on the journey with that client, you know, their insurance journey, because now the kids are a little bit older. We can dial down the life insurance, maybe increase the trauma. And I am always, I am probably one of the biggest advocates for health insurance. You know, I just believe, you know, because that goes through your whole life from a baby to cradle to grave, if you like, not the greatest term, but you know, it can do right through, because there is a need to be able to have yourself fixed. I mean, I don't want to equate us to a car, but you know, you've still got to perform maintenance on a car, and you've got to have repairs, running repairs as you go. And it's the same with us. I think it's just sitting down, Ryan, with that and going through identity. See, I guess insurance is, it's all about risk. And it's saying, okay, so what risk can you retain? Well, if you're talking about life insurance, it's like you're going to have an absolutely perfectly healthy lifestyle. You're not going to go out. You know, avoid. So you're trying to avoid a risk. I mean, if you looked at, so you wouldn't go up a ladder onto the roof, for example, if you're trying to avoid the risk. What can you retain? So if we're sitting with the client, we might say, okay, so with income replacement or income protection, for example, the ideal cover is this kicks into play immediately after, say, you know, 4 weeks. So, you know, of an event that stops you working. But that's quite expensive. So let's say we might build it out to a wait period of 3 months, and that significantly reduces the premiums. So they've retained internally that 3 months. You know, if you're looking at health insurance, we can put an excess on it. So they're retaining, and it could be $500, it could be $1,000, it could be $2,000 excess. So they're retaining that part of it. And then the third part of it, we're transferring the risk. So we're transferring the risk onto the insurer. And, you know, that's where the life insurance is. You know, we're transferring the risk of that person dying and no more income coming to an insurance company. We pay premiums for that. And that's why most people look at the house, I guess. They go, well, I can't afford the house to be burnt down. I'm so invested, it's all my money. I've got a mortgage on it. So we're transferring the risk of that event happening to an insurance company, and we pay premiums for that. Yeah. And with life insurance, health insurance, income replacement, serious illness, that risk will change over the period, you know, over your lifetime.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I'm used to solving problems instead of creating them, because in a way, it's a future problem. I used to yes, door knock and sell really expensive medical gear to people in fucked up health, and they're over their 60s. And they taught us to draw this diagram of like, what's important about your life? And then you draw a squiggle line, and what happens if you lose your mobility? What would you lose? And then you'd quote them on the things that were important to them and make a list. And sometimes they would cry, because obviously they're already in pain. But I'm not really sure. Like, when I ask someone on the phone, I'm like, hey, so what were you actually worried about? Like, well, I'm not worried. I just wanted the product. You know, how do you go down that route of like making them aware without being a dick? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it's listening, it's asking questions. You know, we have a very consultative approach. We never walk in with a predetermined solution. Yeah, because everyone's different. And I think if you start doing that, I think if you go back historically, life insurance has been a little bit like that. Health insurance, a little bit like that. You know, I'm walking the door, Ryan, you need this. You know, if you're a fool, if you don't take this. Yeah, and you're just going to get people, you know, you're on this policy, that's crap. You know, you know, I've just insulted your intelligence because you took that policy out thinking it was a good policy. And it probably was at the time. You know, I mean, how I'd combat that, I'd say, look, at the time, that was probably the very best policy you could take. But times have moved on. So I think it's sitting down, it's actually identifying what is the risk. Most people, you know, I mean, even with health insurance, you know, if you go on the waiting list for 12, 24 months, and it could be longer, the quality of life you're going through could be significantly diminished because of what you're suffering from, but you might be considered, you know, it's not an acute situation, it's an elective situation, so you're not going to get in as a high priority on the waiting list. Or if it's cancer, because cancer is still elective, so you know, if you go to the hospital and they discover cancer, you know, you now go on a list, because I mean, you know, the acute, look at our public system, I believe is one of the absolute very best in the world for an acute situation. You have a car crash, you have a heart attack, you break your leg, you get meningitis, you know, something that's right, it's life-threatening. You're in, you'll be fixed. Everything else you're sort of going to go on a waiting list for. And so it's a really, I don't know, I'm sort of answering your question in a roundabout way, but it's, what do you see at risk? You know, like, you're talking to a young person, and if you start talking about cancer and strokes and heart attacks, well, they're not gonna identify with that. Not at all. Not because most young people in New Zealand are, you know, 10-foot-tall bulletproof. You know, but then responsibilities. I know I didn't actually get any form of life or health insurance till I was 40, and it was like late 30s actually. You know, I'd got married, so kids, and I thought, yeah, I probably should be a bit more responsible for this now. So the need appeared. So it's, you know, the need was there. And it's interesting you say that, because you know that we're one of the worst, I think we're about the second in the OECD most underinsured country in the OECD. You know, and I think there's a general apathy in New Zealand that she'll be right, won't happen to me, I've got ACC, I've got the public system. But the reality is that the public system can only take what it can take. And ACC only cover 1 out of 6 events, or you equate that to 17% of all events that can have you off work, injury by accident. The other 83, or 5 out of 6, if my math is correct, is from sickness, illness, it's degenerative conditions. It is mental health conditions, you know, burnout, fatigue, depression, because you know, insurance will cover that. So people are walking around thinking they're covered, but they're hugely underinsured.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize the implications of, like, you get cancer and two of you are paying for the mortgage, and then you don't even qualify for sickness benefit, and that's only $300 a week. And then you just wrecked. And then the employer fires you after 3 months because money's money.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah. And look, even looking with health insurance, you know, and look, something I'll often say to people is look, most people that I come upon are paying far too much for far too little cover. You know, they're insuring the wrong things. And not all health insurance policies are created equal. And often... I mean, life insurance is pretty standard across most insurance companies. But once you start getting into the traumas, you know, the serious illnesses, the disability covers, there's quite a variance. But if you go to health insurance, you know, there's a lot of people will focus on and probably have been set up through, if they've got a group scheme, and paying for the GPs and the pharmacy scripts. And it, in my opinion, that is not value for money. You know, you're paying for that. It's a dollar swap exercise, you know, because you'll pay the insurance company some money and you go to the GP and you get it back. But your premiums are blown out and you're actually missing the big stuff. So So I actually recommend people don't focus on that. Pick up your GPs, your pharmacy scripts, your dental and optical. Pick that up in your day-to-day budget. But it's the big stuff you need to be protected for. You know, if suddenly, you know, you need surgery. Like one of the things that we deal with a lot is women's issues. You know, because we support Endometriosis New Zealand. You know, we're a partner of theirs. We've been involved. I've been to a number of seminars. I've sat down with a lot of doctors around that. So there's 200,000 women in New Zealand. I think it's 1 in 10, if I remember rightly. 200,000 women in New Zealand suffer from endometriosis or pelvic pain. And this is crippling, you know, crippling for them. But this is a lifestyle condition. You'll be very lucky to get that dealt with in the public system. But you see young women bent over, crippled, or doubled over. They're in bed. They can't go to school. They can't go to work. The pain is so intense. So being able to get that sort of stuff done through a private medical cover, or the big stuff, because as medicine's advancing, you know, and you need a high level of surgical cover. I mean, some policies are topping out at 100,000. So that's a surgical benefit. But we're seeing procedures getting into the multi-hundreds of thousands because, you know, when I started, you know, 20-odd years ago, $50,000-$70,000 was a, whoa, that's a, you know, that's right out there. That's a big claim. Today, that's just a medium one. Yeah, we're seeing them in the hundreds of thousands. So you need a policy that has a high level of that surgical cover. But the other thing is that there's an area of, and this is in the insurance world, called non-surgical. So surgical is defined from an insurance perspective as an incision is made under anesthetic. You think, I don't know why they put that under anesthetic bit in there, but you would think it was under anesthetic. But so you think of all the stuff that they can now and are going to be able to do in the future without performing surgery, you know. So it would be oncology, chemotherapy, radiotherapy. That's non-surgical. Your brachytherapy. So what they used to do in days gone by with prostate cancer, they would remove your prostate. Now they can inject radioactive seeds into your prostate. Gobbles up the cancer cells. The radioactive seeds die, and you pee them out. You know, so that's a $40,000 procedure. It's non-surgical because there's no surgery. Even lithotripsy, which is removal of kidney stones. You know, they used to cut into your kidneys and cut them out. Now they blast them with sound waves. You know, laser treatments. They're actually clearing chronically blocked arteries now without surgery. You know, so they've got some titanium tip that oscillates about 20,000 times a second or so. I can't even comprehend that. Pulverizes the calcium buildup. So the future of medicine is going to be more in the non-surgical than surgical. Because, you know, I've talked to a number of medical professionals who said, look, if we have to resort to surgery, it's almost a, you know, it's a failure. We want to treat them before surgery if we can, or outside of surgery. And when you think of the big picture of that, everybody wins, you know, because, you know, you don't have to stay over. If you're treated without surgery, it's probably a day job in the hospital. You're in and out. You don't need anaesthetist because you're not knocked out. You recover much better. Because you haven't been opened up. So that is the future of medicine. Now, some companies are really light on their non-surgical cover. You know, companies that we support, you know, they have a high level of non-surgical cover. You know, and I know some of the bigger, some companies actually dropped their non-surgical off, where other companies will cover $500,000 per person per year. So, you know, I've seen people, they've gone and they've had the surgery, you know, on these policies, they've gone and they've had the surgery, that's all right. But then they come to the non-surgical, and that could be, you know, so it could be, I don't know, let's say it's a $70,000-$90,000 bowel cancer claim. You know, $30,000-$40,000 could be the surgical component. The other $30,000-$40,000 could be non-surgical. So if you don't have a high level of non-surgical, in my opinion, you're not future-proof, you know, on a health insurance policy. And this where a broker comes in and sits down and explains that to people. And so, but the other really big one, Ryan, at the moment is we call it a non-pharmac funded drug cover. So in New Zealand, we have two agencies. We have MedSafe. Now, MedSafe, their whole government department, their whole mandate is this drug safe? Like the FDA in America, is this drug safe? And if they give it the tick, it's available in New Zealand. Then you've got Pharmac, who, and Pharmac will go, okay, MedSafe have approved it, can we fund it? You know, and they have their budget, so there's only certain things they can fund. You know, and you hear them in the media, and they get a pretty tough time. But they are restricted to a government budget. Now, where this is really important going forward is that the medical world have found a cure for some of the major cancers. So lung, bowel, brain, breast, prostate, those sort of type of cancers. And what they are is called immunology drugs, and it's called immunotherapy. So the reason cancer has been so hard to fight historically is it hides from the body's immune system, and it tricks the body's immune system. We've got these T cells that run around and identify a threat, and then they'll kill it. These cancer cells are hiding from these T cells, our immune system, and tricking it into it's a healthy cell. And then it's too late, you know, and then it's multiplied, because cancer is that massive multiplication of cells. And it creates tumours and so forth. Now, that's a natural process in our body, but there is markers that turn that off. So what the immunotherapy does is exposes the cancer to the body's immune system, and now the immune system fights the cancer and kills it. So it's way better than, say, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, which sort of pretty much breaks everything down and you've got to rebuild. Now, it's not every cancer, and it's not every person, but it's a lot of cancers and a lot of people, and we are in New Zealand. These drugs are available. Pharmac are funding one or two of them. You know, they're funding Keytruda. They initially that was for skin cancer, melanoma, so they funded it for that. But because, and if I just step back a piece here, that these drugs, they are available, but they come at the cost of $150,000, maybe $300,000. But they will cure these people. You know, if they're the right person, it's the right cancer, they will cure them. And so Pharmac can't possibly fund that. And so they've picked and choose a few. And look, and I understand that. I mean, I can be just like everyone else, say, oh, Pharmac are crap. But I don't believe they are. They've got their restrictions and they've got their budget. And they have to make that decision on what they can cover. So there are, there are health insurers out there, and some of the biggest ones out there will say, if Pharmac don't fund it, we don't fund it. But there are a whole raft, well, there's two or three, or four, I guess, health insurers out there right now, written into their policies at no extra cost, is that they will cover non-Pharmac funded drugs. MedSafe have approved them, they will cover them. Now, this is a game changer in the health insurance space. And look, Ryan, it's not only just cancer. I mean, we're talking about Crohn's. We're talking about diabetes. There was a drug just recently, and Pharmac have just approved it, which is quite good for hep C, hepatitis C. So, you know, so this is, in my opinion, this is the future of where medicine is going. And some health insurers don't cover that. They're really good on the basic, if you need a heart bypass, you need a hip replacement, knee replacement, they're great. They're just as good as anyone else. But when it comes to these future-proofing you with, say, non-surgical or non-Pharmac-funded drugs, they don't cut the mustard, to be blunt. And so as a broker, we will go in and explain this to the client. And say, like, what is it you want covered? Now, these ones are no more expensive than the ones that don't cover. It's just, you don't know what you don't know, right?
Mm.
So, yeah, so, like, it's a long-winded explanation of how we would sort of talk to people and what we'd explain to people. And you know, and sometimes we don't quite go into that much depth because they're not interested. They just want to, like, just give me cover.
It was pretty compelling. I mean, one of our clients is, like, he likes the line of, how much would you pay for another year of life? Whereas what you're saying, actually, how much would you pay to still be alive? Which is kind of wild.
Yeah.
But is that what you sort of need to look for health insurance? You look for the level of non-farm cover, so non-government funded cover, making sure it's non-surgical as well as surgical. Those are the three pillars?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, and the ability to, you know, if you, and like I said early on, I wouldn't really be going with, along with the, you know, I'd say fund the GP and pharmacy scripts yourself in your own budget. So that's going to help you reduce your premiums, because premiums are a big factor as well. You want a policy that's got decent excess options available. You know, someone your age wouldn't need an excess option, because it'd be, you know, it would be really affordable. But, you know, as you get older, because, you know, the older we get, the more things break. And so the more likely we are to have surgery, so the premiums go up. So, you know, when you're younger, you know, you have maybe no excess, or you might have a $250 or $500 excess, which means when I go back to when I said earlier on, you retain the $500, so you cover that yourself, but you transfer over to the insurance company to pay the rest, you know, of that. But like a lot of people we find, and most of our clients sort of sitting in their, you know, in their 60s or certainly their 70s, we'd probably recommend they look at maybe a, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 excess. Because at that point, they're probably quite, you know, they've got the asset base. They're just trying to, you know, if they're retired, they're trying to manage their money. So they could probably find $2,000 quite easy if something really nasty happened, and then transfer the rest across. I mean, AIA, for example, just paid, I think it was about $850,000, I think, 2 years for somebody on across. There was a bit of trauma in there, but a lot of that was a non-pharmac funded drug cover.
Yes, wow. You
know, the immunotherapy. So, yeah, that's what you're transferring across. You know, it's quality of life. Because if you need a hip replacement, you know, and I've had one. I broke my hip playing rugby when I was in my 20s. I didn't even know I'd done it, actually. And in my 40s, I had a restricted movement. So I had osteoarthritis set in. And I know how uncomfortable that is. And I can only imagine someone that is later in life living with that and being told, well, the wait list is 2 years, you know. You won't, because of your age, you don't qualify. There'll be younger people. And people are being told that.
Yeah, honestly, that's what I did for, I think, about a year, was just those people with osteoarthritis. It's horrific. Yeah. Like, there was a guy, he had blood clots, he had cancer, but he couldn't get out of bed because of his knees. But then even then, they don't qualify enough because it's a pain threshold. Yeah. I don't know how the point system works, but it ain't pretty. Sitting on a waiting list.
And it goes up and down based on the availability of funding. So you might meet it one day and you don't meet it the next day.
Yeah, charming. I'll be curious, because you've also reached a certain level of scale and people come to you for training. I mean, I'm a believer in the consultative selling and understanding, asking questions, and maybe have a basic frame for that. But how do you actually teach it at scale? You know, like, it's sometimes you have to teach EQ, you know, when their face does this, did you notice why I did that? Like, what do you go through to help become an exceptional advisor when you're training them?
Yeah, like, for an advisor to be successful in our industry, they have to be client focused. You know, you can't think, look, the insurance industry is a good industry, it's a profitable industry, we make good money, there's no doubt about it. But if you, I've never walked into a meeting thinking what commission's on the table. It's always what's at risk here? How can I help that person? So, it is being able to go in and being curious, what's going on here? And people in most cases are not aware of the risk that they're under, you know, with the more, you know, and just asking that simple question, you know, what would happen if one of you were to die tomorrow? How would you get by financially? Or you couldn't work. How are you going to get by? You know, how long can you survive without income? Sorry. So, first of all, you've got to have the right mindset. You know, you've got to be, you got to enjoy people, really. And you want to help. And I know people see us as salespeople, and, you know, and there is a certain amount of selling. I mean, the selling side of it, is selling people on the idea of the risk, you know, because a lot of people aren't sold on the idea that they have a risk, that they need insurance. So it's just reselling the idea that they need it. Then you can become the consultant. And so you would do that by going through and asking sort of questions along the way. It's not coming in to sell a product. Probably our first meeting is really a fact-find process. And I've designed a number of templates and fact finds that lead through that consultative phase. One of the questions I'd ask you if I was talking to you about health insurance, I'd say, so Ryan, if you're considering health insurance, what would you want to know about that policy? So I'm not telling you what you should have, you know, what would you want to know? And then that would sort of lead me to probably explaining some of the things like I've explained before, you know. You would probably come back to me and say, well, I want to know what it's going to cost me and what I'm covered for. And then I can break that down and say, well, there's two ways to reduce the cost of health insurance. One is to, you know, focus on hospitalization only, you know, pick up the GP and pharmacy scripts in your budget, excess options, undercover, the area of cover. Then I would talk a little bit about non-surgical and surgical and non-pharmacy funded drugs. But I'm letting you sort of lead the way a little bit there. And so then I'm going to and find out what is the risk and what is important to both of you. You know, if you're married and the children, were you in the ideal world, would the kids be going to private schools? Depending on their age, they might not know that at this point. Will they be going to university? And so it's putting in, finding out what is important to these people. And then I would come back with a recommendation. So we go away and we do a little bit of research. We put together, as I said, a personal protection plan. We say, look, this is what we believe is at risk, what you've said you want. And, you know, the desired result, if you like. And here's a summary of what I recommend. And then we work through again. In the ideal world, they'll take the whole lot. But most times people can't afford what is ideal. So everyone wants, if you're in Auckland, I'm sure everyone would love a home on the water in Herne Bay, you know. But the reality is not everyone can afford that. So, you know, but they can afford a home somewhere else. They just need a home so we can get it. So again, with us, it's about finding out, getting some cover. But yeah, look, I think it's just going through, you know, and then I would sit with my guys, you know, and sometimes if it's someone that's certainly within Adelphi Insurance Brokers, they would come in the field with me and I would be doing hopefully what I've just taught them to do in a live situation. And then I'll monitor them as they go through. And I can pick up pretty quickly if things are missing, even from, you know, if I'm not there, you know, because they're not asking the right questions. You know, because I mean, look at a consultative approach, because you know, there's an old saying: a person convinced against their will is of the same opinion still. So if you go in and look, and I always remember just like an example, and I use this with my guys. You know, I'll give you two examples on how I would start. Oh, actually, three examples. You think about, you go to a doctor, and if you walked into the doctor and he's go, you just walk in the door, he or she goes, hey Ryan, you need this, take the script, there you go. You go, yeah, okay. All right. You may or may not take that to the chemist or the pharmacy, because that's a transaction. You know, so what you go to the doctor will say, so tell me what are your symptoms? What's going on? How do you feel? You know, look up your records, look down your throat, listen to your heart, your blood pressure, whatever they're doing. And so at the end of that consultation, they will give you a recommendation. They write you a script, basically, which is their recommendation. Whether you take it or not, it's up to you. But then you take that to the pharmacy. The pharmacy gives you the pharmaceuticals. So that's the transaction. So one's a consultation, one's a transaction. And I remember, you know, and how I built our process was, I remember going to this naturopath because I was having some stomach issues. And he asked me all these questions. He spent 40 minutes asking me these questions, right down to how many times I went to the loo and what it looked like and all that sort of stuff. And at the end, he prescribed this horrible tasting tincture. But I thought, must be important because he spent all that time finding out about me. So what he's recommended must be right. And, so that's the difference between a consultative approach and a transactional approach. I was trying to buy a camera case once. It was just a simple little example. I walked in, said, I want a camera case. The guy goes, you need this one. And I'm going, oh, I don't really like that one. No, I'm not sure that'll fit. No, this is the best one. You need all this. So what did I say? I'll think about it. I had the cash. I wanted to buy. He didn't ask me a single question, told me what I needed. Honestly, I went, five shops down there. It was another camera shop on Queen Street in Auckland. Walked in. The guy says, oh, you want a camera case? Well, I asked the camera case. He says, what do you need it for? What sort of camera you got? What are you doing? Are you traveling? Is it going to be? So he consulted with me. So I just basically gave him the cash and bought it off. So that was the big difference between a transactional and consultative approach.
Makes sense.
I don't know if that answered your question, but
No, I mean, consultative. Yeah, I'm a big believer in it, and it's a lot easier to remember that than a script like five questions or whatever. What do you?
Sorry, mate. Just before you go there, I don't believe in the big clever closes. That was a 1970s, 1980s thing out of America. Had all these big clever closes. The close is at the beginning of the meeting. The person is trying to figure out, do I trust this person? And, so in that first phase of the meeting, you're going to build trust or you're going to create doubt. Amount of advisors have come back to me over the years, said, look, I've got to get my clothes better. I said, probably not your clothes, it's probably your opening. Oh, what do you mean? Because if you haven't built the trust early on, and you do that by being a consultant. And I say to my guys, imagine yourself in a white coat, you got a clipboard, I'm just asking you the questions. You're not talking about product. You're not recommending anything. You're not even discussing insurance. Insurance you are, but not a particular policy. Then you need to get the buy-in. So once you've identified with what someone wants and you've built that trust, then the buy-in. You need to maybe have some things that you can show them. And we use a folder with some, maybe if we're talking about health insurance, for example, we would be looking at newspaper articles where some people have been on long waiting lists and some people have lost their lives because they couldn't get access to these drugs. Then, so I'm being almost a teacher, I said, so get out of your white coat, imagine yourself, you've got the whiteboard, you're now teaching them, you're just educating them a little bit. Then based on what they've told you they want, then you sort of will come back with the product. So now you're being a salesman, effectively. But all you're doing is showing them how to get what they've said they wanted on the way through. And then right at the end, the close, in my opinion, is just a natural consequence of the process. So they're taking what you – because you've got to earn the right to give someone advice. That's the key. So if I just come into you and said, Ryan, you need to do this. With your lady, this is how you should treat her. You do this and that, and you go, piss off. you have zero right to speak into my life. You haven't earned that right. Some people close to you might have, your mum, your dad, your best buddies, some mentors in your life have, but I don't. Because I don't have that, other than the relationship we've developed here, I don't have that right to speak into your life. And so that's the same when we're sitting down with a client. If I'm going to bowl in there, and I'm going to frighten them with, you need this or that, your policy you've got crap, it won't cover this or that, they're just, no. I haven't earned the right to say that yet. So you earn the right in that consultative phase to give the advice at the end. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And to me, that's how you sell consultatively.
Interesting. Yeah, I always used to say rapport is like earning the right for them to listen to you, and you do that by listening first. It's interesting 100%. That you applied that across.
100%.
I'll be curious with 100%. In terms of like when you face, and last question because we're crossing over time, when you face the objection, so you're doing consultative, and I know the old sales pitch is like, you pretend to understand then tell them why they're wrong. What do you normally, how would you approach, oh, I've already got cover, or, you know, I need to talk to my partner, or affordability, whatever objection. What do you do then?
Look, it varies a lot, but I think, again, it's yeah. I mean, one of the ones you're going to get a lot is, I need to think about it. You know, and often I say, look, that's fantastic. You know, what is it you need to think about? You know, look, I understand. You know, we just need to think about it overnight or whatever. So, look, I fully understand that. I think that's a really good idea. You know, if it's a good idea today, it'd be a good idea tomorrow. But what is it you need to think about? Because while I'm here, and I can then answer the questions. Affordability is okay. So, you know, okay, if we can make it affordable, you know, what is there anything else that would stop you, you know, you're taking this cover out? And then what I would do is I would bring up the quote and say, okay, what can we do without? What is the bare necessities right now? And often you will find that people, we really do need that, I suppose. And that'll change. So I would work them into that equation. I've already got cover. Well, early on, I've identified the cover. I've already talked about, and there will be a point in there, you know, where the cover that they've got doesn't meet the needs that they really want. And then it's coming back, bringing them back to that. Because if you answer the questions early on, it's very easy to go back. I mean, and I guess, again, very early on in my meeting, and I teach my guys to open the meeting basically by saying, purpose of this meeting, Ryan, is to look at your circumstances, your needs, see if we can find the best level of cover at the best price. Or you might already be on it. We'll know in a few minutes. You know, and you say that with a bit of a twinkle in your eye, you know, but the thing is, you know, the as we've gone through the process, you know, you've set the posture for the meeting. You know, well, I've got cover, and it's, you know, I've got cover. Okay, well, that's fine. If you are on that, I will tell you. But explain to me what is the cover? You know, what cover do you have? Yeah, so look, it's just going through that. I think, you know, look, most people have insurance, but often the product mix is wrong. You know, and again, if you said, look, I think this cover is really good, and I don't think it is good, you know, I'm not going to bag the company, I'm not going to bag you for your decision. I'm going to say, look, when you took that out, Ryan, that was probably the best level of cover, you know, and probably at the best price. But things have changed. Health insurance evolved. New companies covering medical procedures have evolved. This policy that met your needs then won't meet your needs today. So that as well. Really, I mean those and probably the biggest thing. I mean, I guess if I'm looking at, I'd say health insurance, I would say to somebody, look, because one of the things that do trip us up with health insurance, and we have to be careful, we have to be mindful of this, because often we will recommend people stay put. And look, honestly, if they are on the right level of cover and it's the right price for them, we will recommend them to stay put. And I would say 60% of people we get in front of, we say, look, you've got the right cover, stay on that, because you've got too many pre-existing medical conditions. If we move you off that, it's going to... you're going to have those excluded. It's not in your best interest to do that. And, you know, so we still have that responsibility. We can't just sell everybody. It's, you know, it's not ethical. But I will show some people that say, look, if you stay on this company here, and you might, and let's say it's something fairly serious like a knee, look, if we move you there, you are going to lose cover for your knee. But if you stay there, you're not covered for non-pharmacological drugs. You have no non-surgical cover. What is more important to you? And I'm not going to make that decision for you. Mm. Because you do come here, this will be excluded. But if you stay here, this is excluded.
That's smart. Yeah, ask them what's important and give them the option.
Yeah, so look, mate, that was probably, you know, that's probably, you know, again, it's not clever. It's not clever one-liners. It's not... There's no pressure involved because if someone signs up, they can cancel it tomorrow. So, you know, we don't want that. We want them comfortable with what they've got. We then have to, we get audited, and the FMA will come around and look at our stuff at different times. And we have to show them what was the process and thinking we went through to move them to that product. And it has to be client-centric. I mean, that's one of our core values at Adelphi. Client is at the center of everything we do. And if you focus on that, you know, you'll be successful.
Well, on that note, thanks for coming on the podcast, mate.
Hey, pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Ryan.